I await your blue light. Perfect. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Today is Tuesday, March 10th, 2015. I'm opening a meeting of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on General Government and opening a public hearing on House Bill 5035 relating to the Department of Revenue. Mr. Buchholz, Mr. Smith, anybody else joining you at the moment? Yes. Mr. Ayer. Excellent. Thank you. Gentlemen, the floor is yours.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Jim Buchholz, Director of your Department of Revenue. Today will be about two things. Today is about the update on where we are on our core system replacement and where we hope to go over the next biennium. And then Ken Ross of our personal income tax program is going to come and lead a discussion about personal income tax refund fraud.
Excellent. Thank you.
Well, good afternoon, co-chairs. Representative Kahl. My name is Eric Smith, and I am the administrator of the Program Management Office of the Department of Revenue. And it's with great pleasure that we get to come before you today and give you an update on our core systems replacement. I plan to provide an overview, talk a little bit about the business drivers, talk about Rollout 1, some of the keys to our success with our first rollout, provide a status update for Rollout 2, which we're in the midst of, share with you how we're performing this biennium with our budget and what we are looking forward to in 15-17 with our budget request. Happy to entertain questions as we go or at the end.
And Mr. Smith, if you don't mind, I'm just going to interrupt shortly. Representative Compa and Representative Hurd are both new to our committee, so Representative Smith and I are both relatively conversant at this point with this project, but if there are places, Representative Hurd and Representative Comp, where you need a little extra background, please don't hesitate to ask. We want to make sure you're familiar with this, since it will be an ongoing issue before this subcommittee. Apologize for the interruption, Mr. Smith. I just want to make sure everybody's on a level, as level playing field as possible, all things considered.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. And if I may, what I will do is provide a bit more of an overview for your benefit.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yes, okay. We have a great deal of gratitude for being able to start on the project. Thank you for funding it. We have a number of staff who have been working on this project full-time, and then a great many more staff who have really stepped up to the plate in this first rollout and now in rollout two to help us be successful. And I just really wanted to acknowledge that right out of the gate. This has been a great team effort. It began in 2009 when we started building our business case, and the two primary business drivers for the Department of Revenue to replace our core systems are, number one and foremost, to avoid risk. We were operating in legacy systems that were becoming more and more difficult to sustain, and I'll touch on that a little bit more in a moment. But number two, we saw an opportunity to be able to improve our performance and improve our business practices. So those are the two key primary business drivers. We're also very fortunate to be in a workspace that there are some vendors who have developed commercial off-the-shelf solutions. And we selected Gentax, which is built by Fast Enterprises out of Denver, Colorado. It's been in production for over 15 years, and we were the 19th state revenue agency to implement Gentax, and there are now 20 state revenue departments in the United States who use Gentax. We will be replacing about two-thirds of our legacy systems when we're through implementing Gentax. And if you look at the pipeline graph there, Rollout 1, which we completed on time and under budget on November 12th of 2014, we implemented corporation tobacco and cigarette tax programs. Rollout 2, which we're in the midst of right now and will go live this fall, is where we're implementing personal income tax and a few other programs, which I'll get into in a moment. Rollout 3 will be the withholding tax programs and some other programs, and then Rollout 4, our remaining programs.
I'm going to interrupt for 1 second. I hope that you all heard the keywords on time and under budget, and given the scope,
within scope,
exactly. No project creep, no major glitches, superb project management, great team involvement, and really a model for how big IT projects should happen in this state. And I really want to commend all of you for sticking to that. Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Comp, please.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I co-chair of the education sub, so if you can move $20 million over into the education budget, I would be greatly appreciative.
I didn't say that we could quite get there. We're trying to save font tech. We're trying to save.
I'm sincere, and Representative Smith knows what we deal with.
I do appreciate that, Representative Comp, and it is a challenge. But we do appreciate your fiscal stewardship.
Yeah, seriously.
Your lack of stress. I want to point out, we didn't hear anything about the rollout in November. There was nothing in the newspapers. There was nothing on the news. There was nothing anywhere. And that's because there was nothing to report except a system that went live the way it was supposed to.
Madam Chair,
so yay, all of you.
May I just say thank you for that. And I know that we have several staff that are listening. And really, it was about the staff. That we have a tremendous team back at home that put this together, and so thank you for that. We're deflecting that to them.
Well, yeah, and I didn't mean to minimize their contribution. And you said yesterday, I think 120,000 hours of person time.
Yes,
and it shows because the attention to detail and the risk management associated with it, and the close work with Mr. Borden and with folks from the Chief Information Officer's staff, and with Mr. McSpaden from LFO, really shows. And keep going, but I want to put that on the record because you minimized that, Mr. Smith, and I don't think it should be minimized. That's a substantial achievement by your team. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. The last point I'll make on this slide, the overall estimated cost for the project, it'll be $81 million through completion. $65 million of that $81 million is what we estimate it'll cost us to implement. We estimate about $9 million in finance costs. A significant portion of this project, and I'll talk about this a little later, is bond financed. And then we spent $7 million between the summer of 2009 and the summer of 2013 just to get ready to do procurement, get our project management in space. So the total cost, we're estimating at $81 million. And we can say, yay, we completed rollout one. Again, to the business drivers, just a little bit more information. Think of this as just a reinvestment in our capital infrastructure. And the reason we wanted to go with a commercial off-the-shelf solution is we didn't want to keep coming back every 15 or 20 years and doing another remodel, another upgrade of our systems. And so by purchasing a commercial off-the-shelf solution, and as we work with you for our maintenance and support funding after implementation, we will be able to keep our systems current well into the future. Anytime there's a system upgrade or a version upgrade, we will go ahead and modernize it with that upgrade. And we just thought that was the best business strategy that we could adopt.
I have a quick question about that that's never occurred to me asked, or maybe I asked and I forgot the answer. If you look at, for example, Microsoft Office, which is a program suite that many of us have become familiar with, the you know, version 7, the 0.1, 0.2, 0.3, whatever, those upgrades are usually free. But when you get to version 8, then you have to pay for it. So is that the situation with Gentax? Or thank you very much. Or is that, will these be basically like the dot versions between versions with that will be essentially free as long as you continue to pay the maintenance engagement costs? Or how does that work in this business?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. It depends on the level of maintenance and support that we purchase. And we're going to recommend the level that does include the version upgrades within the cost at no extra cost.
Okay.
And what that means is when there's a version upgrade, and then we will get the service packs in between as well. But when we have a version upgrade, FAST will send a team to help us install that. And if there are changes, if you're familiar like your Microsoft Office example, sometimes you have to learn how the different programs look. If there are changes to the program, they'll help us develop some training too. But that's what our recommendation will be. And we'll be coming into the 2017 session with those details.
Yeah, and if I just want to remind the committee or mention to those who don't know it, part of the issue is here, you guys are not customizing this platform, right? The service packs that come through may come from suggestions that you have, but they will get rolled out for everybody. They won't be unique to Oregon, right? Or if another state that's using Gentax has a suggestion about an upgrade or a feature that's missing, when that service pack comes out, everybody who has this product will get it, right? It's not anything that's going to be unique to Oregon.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Yeah, and I think that was a very sensible choice.
Yeah, our goal is to, and I'll touch on this a little bit more in a moment, our goal is to implement without customizing. We will only customize if we absolutely have to meet our business needs. And in rollout one, we did not do any customization.
That's great. Thank you.
You're welcome. The other thing that we're really looking forward to is opportunities to improve our performance by adopting a solution that has been used in many other revenue agencies. We believe we're going to be able to, and we've already started to, improve our compliance practices and how we handle revenue in the programs that are already in rollout one. We look for areas where we're going to be able to increase our efficiency. There's things we do manually now where we'll hopefully be able to automate and use those resources in a better way. We'll be partnering with you, and I'll talk about this in a moment, about what those redeployment resources might look like when we discover those. One feature, this system has a great web portal, and so we're able to offer a number of self-service customer services for our taxpayers and their practitioners that we have not been able to offer all of our programs before, and so we're pleased with that. And then finally, the system is a configurable system. It administers over 900 different tax types in the jurisdictions that they're in nationally. And so as policy changes take place, we're optimistic that we'll be able to make those changes to our system fairly quickly and affordably to be responsive to those needs. This is a screenshot of one of the systems in our legacy environment, and I just share that so that you can be familiar with the green screen environment we're working in. We have a number of legacy systems that were very well built in their day. They served our purposes very well. Our team has done a great job of keeping them going, but they came to the end of their useful life, and it was becoming more and more difficult to maintain them. And here's a screenshot of what the Gentax system looks like. The tabs that you see there, once you learn the information or the features or the function that are on each of those tabs, it's much easier to move through the system with the click of a mouse. The areas that you see that are the blue highlights, you can click on those and drill down into the system. You can drill all the way down even to see the check, if they paid by check, to see what the check was that they paid and who signed it. And so the system is integrated, and it's able to navigate quite easily. And staff seem to be picking it up quite well. A little bit about our journey, these next three slides. When we had done our business case and done our background work to present to you the reason for why we needed to replace our systems, we had discovered we'd gotten the most out of our legacy systems, and we had a number of workarounds in our organization to try to continue to meet our business needs using those systems. And we discovered that we weren't alone. About two-thirds of the revenue departments across the country at the time of our business case were either replacing or have replaced their systems. Where we're going, as I mentioned, we're primarily doing this to reduce the long-term risk to revenue. But one of the intangible benefits, if you will, of being a part of this community of states that's using the same system is we have a network now of peers across the country who are doing compliance activities in the same types of tax programs we are. We're able to share data with those other agencies. Every night, if a state finds some return information that appears to be suspect or fraudulent, that is shipped to us overnight so we can load it into our system to monitor for that type of information. We meet twice a year to talk about what are the things that we want to do to improve our practices and what are some of the system changes that will help us to do that. And it's really expanded our footprint, and it's not a small thing to be a part of 20 states to be able to work on our compliance strategies instead of doing that on our own. And then the other thing, as I mentioned, we're going to be able to provide services customers expect. Customers are expecting to deal with you electronically, and this system's allowing us to do that much more readily. How we got here, we did extensive research. We developed our business case. We also did a lot inside the revenue agency. We built an enterprise architecture plan and developed a lot of project management plans that have been bedrock for us to be able to manage the project and to be able to communicate with vendors as we brought them on as to what our plans are and how we plan to execute the project. A quick overview of Rollout 1, if I may.
Yeah, I'm not sure when the right time is to ask this question, so I'm going to ask it, and if you don't want to answer it now, you can tell me when you do want to answer it.
Okay.
I was looking at your big governor's recommended budget document, and one of the things that concerned me was the issue about the struggles that you're having hiring enough IT people at the pay that we're able to offer. And at some point, as we talk about this project, I'd like you to address talk about that problem. It's not the first time we've heard this this year, and it is a significant issue. So I'd love for you to address it. And if you don't have time today, then either you can bring it back in phase two or you can send us a memo talking about it. But I do think that's a significant issue about being able to hire qualified personnel, and we've got to be sure that we can do that adequately.
Madam Chair, we'll bring that back to you.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. As we touched on briefly with the opening slide, for rollout one, we have over 1,200 business requirements that we identified at the beginning of the project for all four rollouts, and for the three programs in rollout one, that's corporation, cigarette, and tobacco, around 1,100 of those requirements were in scope. And we were able to meet all the necessary business requirements for us to be able to administer the programs that were in rollout one. We are also, there's a very large part of a project like this is how do you handle your legacy systems? We have legacy systems that have been doing our business for us. Some of them are going to survive through each rollout until the last rollout, for example, our accounting system, because it's the one accounting system that we use for all of our programs. And so we had to make changes to certain systems so that they would not recognize activities for the programs once they went live in Gentax. Some systems we were able to retire, for example, our corporate tax return processing system we no longer needed. And then there are other systems where we had to synchronize. For example, all the payments that the Department of Revenue now receives come in through Gentax, and then we pass those payments either back to legacy or they stay if those programs are still in legacy systems because they're in future rollouts, or they stay for the programs that are in Gentax. So our team did a very good job of making the changes necessary to our legacy systems. All the functionality in the new system to administer the programs was verified and tested. We converted data to the extent of about 125,000 customers and over 400,000 returns from our legacy systems into the new system. We had over $4 billion in tax that we brought over to the system that we were able to reconcile to the penny. And so we were very, very pleased with how our rollout went. And I'll touch on, there's a slide that I have that'll touch on some of the keys in a moment that will give you some insight of why we think we were successful with that. But here's the no customization of Gentax, which you touched on. And what that means is we're having to change business processes. If you had a legacy system and you had a business process that was set up to be able to use that system, and then you bring in a modern tool set that has a different way of doing business, you need to work with your team to change your business process in order to continue to do work. And we did quite a bit of that in certain areas of the agency. There were 10 areas that were more impacted than others. And that's how we were able to implement without customizing the system. Went live on schedule November 12th. All the system worked, old and new. Our interfaces worked with places like state treasury and state printing, and we were under budget. I wanted to take a moment, if I may, and just talk about, okay, so the new system's up and running. How do you know it's working? What are the benefits you're seeing so far in the system? And we've been in the system now for almost 4 months. As of, this is a point in February that I grabbed the information from, we've processed 325,000 payments for almost $600 million. 550 million of those have passed back to the legacy systems where programs are waiting to be implemented in a future rollout. We've issued over 20,000 notices, issued over 1,700 returns, and over 500 taxpayers have registered online for services that they did not have before. In the corp audit function, Gary Humphrey gave a presentation to House Revenue a couple weeks ago, and he talked at great detail, which I won't be able to provide for you, but about the audit function and the filing enforcement function and some of the new functionality that they have with the data being integrated in the system, and for them to do better case selection, it's easier for the staff to use, and for them to identify corporate non-filers. And so they're pleased early on with how the system is able to help them improve their work as well. On the slide here, I've listed a half a dozen things that we got in addition to our business requirements. When we established our business requirements, we had an idea of what the world would look like as we were looking forward to replacing our systems. But Gentax offers a number of things, and these are just a half a dozen that we weren't even thinking of. For example, real-time processing. Legacy systems require night batch jobs, in some cases several night batch jobs to complete a transaction. When we handle a transaction in our new system, it uploads real time and you can see instantly what account balances are. and payments post, things like that. Risk scoring for refund review. We have a robust review refund review process, but with the opportunity within Gentex to look at different types of behaviors or systems or transactions or events, we've been able to develop risk scoring that helps flag refunds that might be getting ready to be issued for us to do a further review upon. The next one is a big item, and that's to be able to review an exact copy of correspondence. If you can imagine being able to be in a field office or in Salem, or even the taxpayer if they have an online account, if we've issued a notice or correspondence, they can click on through their account and they can see the correspondence that we've sent to them if they happen to lose it. If a taxpayer calls anyone in the department, they can go ahead and handle the call and they can pull up the correspondence that the taxpayer is looking at while they're looking at it. The enhanced online services that I've mentioned, so they can do an account lookup. They can see what their balances are for the accounts that are in the system. They can change an address. They can make payments. Cigarette distributors can order cigarette stamps online now. Those are all features that these taxpayers in Rollout 1 were not able to do before.
Mr. Chair, or Madam Chair.
Yes.
Chair Johnson. If they can order the stamps online, one presumes that they are returned electronically?
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, the cigarette stamps.
Yeah, they can order them online. Then, but there's no possibility that those kind of computer communications could be corrupted in a way that would be deleterious.
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, I don't believe so. I believe it's placing an order for the stamps, and they're shipped to the distributor, who then applies them.
Okay.
Yes, they apply them to the cigarette packages.
Okay, thanks.
It's basically just like ordering regular postage stamps from the USPS.com website.
Exactly.
And that just wasn't possible before. They had to call in or write in for them.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Appreciate the clarification. Thanks for the question.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I mentioned the drill down feature on an earlier slide. And then we can also view original and amended returns. Instead of requesting a paper file to come to your desk, we can see those online and have them up on the desk side by side. So those are many of the positive features, but with a commercial off-the-shelf solution, you get what you get. And there are some areas in the organization where we are, some people might think they're taking a step back. And one example I'll give, for example, being an integrated tax system, the data is more sophisticated in this system than we were used to in our legacy systems. And so our research team, as they partner with, for example, Legislative Revenue Office or Office of Economic Analysis, has to put in a great deal more effort right now to understand the data that's in the system so they can extract it and use it in their economic modeling programs or whatever that looks like. And so there are puts and takes to some degree. And so there are some things where it's more challenging for us than it used to be because of the nature of the system. But we're putting resources to it. We're making good headway, but I just want to make sure that you're aware and we're aware there are puts and takes with the COT solution, and there are some things where we're having to do things a little bit differently than we used to do, and it's taking a little more effort.
So just to clarify, this example that you gave, is that something where there's a learning curve and eventually it'll be a good thing, but right now it's just challenging for everybody, or is this something that in the long term is we're getting more or less than we actually wanted?
Madam Chair, it's the former.
Okay, good. That's what I thought, but I just wanted to clarify. Yeah. Thank you.
I would say, though, that this was an aha for me about commercial off-the-shelf systems. When you think in terms of a commercial off-the-shelf system, you think about it being better for your business overall. And in the overall sense, that's true, but for certain areas there may actually be a step backward for us where we'll have to do something, some sort of a workaround to be able to get our business done in that particular area. It's just like when you buy a new car because you're getting some increased utility to yourself, but there may be pieces of that old car that you like better. Maybe it handled better. You know, and there are puts and takes. There are things that you have to accept with a commercial off-the-shelf system.
And are those the kinds of things that you have conversations about in this users group that Mr. Smith was describing, that you talk about, gosh, here's a place we're having to take a big step backwards, what are the rest of you doing about this, and should we be recommending that this be one of the next changes?
Madam Chair, that's our hope. That is our hope. We like Eric said, with 2 times a year we meet with these conferences with the other states, and what the states do is they drive the work of the vendor for what they're going to do with the enhancements to the next version of the system that comes out. We're hopeful because in many respects, Oregon has been ahead of mm-hmm. several other states, so we're hopeful that we're going to be able to bring our expertise to the table and do something that's going to benefit the other 20 state or the other 19 states.
Great, thank you.
Mm-hmm. And this is the last slide with regard to rollout one. There are several keys, we believe, for the success of the project. Four that I would point out. One, with the project's delay, we originally were trying to start up in 2012, and we were delayed 1 year to 2013. We were able to do two things. Our technical environment was able to get really solidified. We were able to make sure that we had everything in place, not only at revenue, but with the data center, ETS, so that when the software vendor showed up, they showed up in October of 2013, and they had the software installed within about a week. And we were already being able to use it in the agency and to start configuring the system. And so we were very well prepared from a technical standpoint, and our IT services team did a great job there. And the other thing, we were in the program management office, we were able to get our project management plans and documentation in great shape too. So when the vendor showed up, there were some things we had to true up based on their methodology, but we were ready to go, and we use those documents regularly for managing schedule, managing risk, for managing our budget. And so the benefit of the delay was we were very prepared, and we're leveraging the benefit of that throughout the implementation. But the two other things that I'd like to point out that I think are really unique to the FAST implementation methodology and that we think are outstanding methods. The first is multiple mock data conversions.
Multiple mock data conversions.
Thank you. I just didn't hear what
I'm sorry.
Wasn't there.
The biggest variable in a successful IT project is how well can you convert the data from your legacy systems into the new system, and how well the data behave in the new system. We practiced, I think, 9 or 10 mock conversions for several months prior to going live, and we practiced 2 full mock conversions the few weeks before we went live. And with each mock conversion, when we convert our legacy data into the new system, you would see how does the data behave in the new system, and if it doesn't behave the way you expect it to, you understand why, and then you mitigate that. And we found over 30 different types of data anomalies, and we were able to mitigate all those data anomalies so that when the system went live on November 12th, we had taken care of the vast majority of the concerns that we had with regard to our data working in the new system. And you can't do projects this big without finding some things even after you go live, and we found a few things afterwards, but nothing of significance. And so multiple mock conversions was a big key for our success.
Madam Chair.
Sorry, Representative Comp.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I've dealt with a lot of data systems over the years in the school systems, and sometimes they're pretty big systems. Did you feel that, and we regretfully never did, a mock scenario, mm-hmm. and I could see where that would be very valuable, but did you find it was worth your time and effort? It's that simple.
Mr. Chair, Representative Comp, absolutely. It's by far the best thing that we did to make sure when we went live the system would work the way we wanted it to. And it's bedrock of FAST implementation methodology. We'll start doing some mock conversions in May for rollout 2. And you start with smaller slivers of the data. You take a sliver across the data and you see how does it behave. And then you take bigger slices and bigger slices. We have a large amount of data for personal income tax. In rollout 1, we converted about 125,000 customers. For rollout 2, we'll do 3.5 million customers. And so we're going to rehearse this very well.
Okay.
Madam Chair, Representative Kump, may I just add on to that? And one of the benefits that a side benefit out of that I got personally was peace of mind. I was able to sleep. If you don't do the conversion until the day before you flip the switch, right, you're worried about what's going to happen. And we knew with relative certainty that the project was going to be successful well earlier before the switch was actually flipped.
Yeah.
Just the follow-up statement. It's very difficult to watch right now as our schools are going to a new testing platform, and it's like Oh, when they, yeah, when they flip the switch because they haven't had an opportunity to test it out to see, yeah, if the teachers even know how to run it, much less the students. And so I really appreciate this conversation. It's very meaningful.
It strikes me that two things. One is it strikes me as the software version of measure twice, cut once, which I think is a good thing for us to keep in mind for those of us who do any woodworking or anything else that requires measuring and cutting. But the other thing that you alluded to, and I don't know if you made clear earlier in your presentation, not only are you using a commercial off-the-shelf system that has been implemented in many other states, there's also a methodology that FastTax has you guys using. And yes, there are some adjustments that you're making, but they have learned over these other implementations how to do this as smoothly as possible. And so not only are you not inventing a new computer program, you're also not inventing the process for implementing the new computer program, which has real value as well, because that's going to reduce the number of glitches. And yeah, I'm sure there have been some, there's been a little bit of customization there, but that's different than inventing your whole process yourself. So I think that's been equally helpful to this, is my sense from the conversations we've had over the past 18 months about this.
Yes, Madam Chair, you're correct. And FAST has had over 160 implementations around the world successfully on schedule.
Thank you.
But if I may, Madam Chair, Representative Comp, you set up my second and my final key to success, and that is there's a staging environment that looks exactly like the production environment that is available a few months before we go live. And we are able to have the staff who will be working in the system come in. And so we run, say, our daily batch jobs through. We'll run our returns and payments through our legacy systems for the day because they haven't converted the new system. We'll take that same job stream and we'll run it through Gentex, and we'll have some staff from those areas look at how the system is handling that work in the system. And they're helping us continue to refine to make sure the system behaves the way it does so that we're making sure when we deploy it, it's working as it should. But they're also learning. They're seeing how the system's going to work weeks, sometimes months, before they're actually asked to do it live in the job. And so that's the second big key, is having a staging environment where we can practice with actual data how is the system going to behave.
Thank you.
If I may, to rollout two, the status update for rollout two, this will be brief. We're implementing personal income tax, self-employed transit, estate and trust, senior disabled and deferral, and emergency communications in this rollout. Again, we're striving to avoid customization. We're scheduled to go live this fall. We've actually selected our go-live date, but we're announcing it to the agency tomorrow. So we'll let you know if you want later on. We don't want to announce it here.
Thank you. Reasonable.
And we look to be poised if we're able to continue through the budget process for 15-17. We'll be poised to be in good shape from our budget perspective as well. All I would say, and I know Director Buchholz mentioned this yesterday, this is a much, much bigger rollout than rollout one. And it's going to be all in for this rollout and then as well as for rollout three. Just because of the magnitude of the accounts, we have twice as many employees who will be impacted by this system, so the training is going to be much more extensive. And so this biennium, the 15-17 biennium, is going to be a monumental task for us to get through these two rollouts.
What's your level of confidence at this point?
Very high.
Very high.
Okay.
Very high.
I'm not going to hold you to that if something happens, but but I'm just curious, like, are you worried? Should we be knowing that you're worried, or are you think things are basically on track?
Madam Chair, we're not worried. We're just cautiously, you know, we're just being cautious. There's a great deal. The team is seasoned. They have one rollout under their belt. They're seeing things for the second time. It's just there's a great deal of work, and it's going to take a lot of effort.
Perfectly reasonable. I just wanted to understand what you were really saying. Mm-hmm.
If I may, moving into the just a brief budget overview, the budget for the project is really sourced in three dimensions. A piece of it is from our existing budget. There are three positions, including mine, that are dedicated to the project from the agency that are just a part of our agency's base budget. Another piece is the general fund portion of our budget, and that pays for data center costs, It pays for maintenance and support costs. The first year of maintenance and support, we could pay for bond proceeds. All the rest of those have to be out of general fund. And we worked with DAS CFO office in establishing what was the right way to source the funds for these. Services and supplies are also paid for out of SNS. And then it's a separate conversation, but we're having to start to repay the bonds that we have sold. And so that's also a general fund payment that we will receive this biennium, we hope. For bond funds, we pay for the contract expenses for the solution provider, quality assurance. We have contractors that help us with change leadership and project management. Our facilities, the staff that you have given us that are permanently dedicated to the project, hardware, software, those are the types of things that we are paying for out of bond proceeds. As you can see, for 15-17, spending remains under budget. Our general fund savings are from lower than anticipated state data center ETS costs. And the other fund savings are primarily as a result of you've given us a contingency, which we still need to hang on to because we don't know what we don't know for the next three rollouts. But we haven't needed to spend one penny of that for this biennium. And so that's $3 million of the savings under the other funds and the bond proceeds. Also, our hardware and software costs are lower. And we had a later start date than anticipated for rollout one. It took a little longer to get approval. And so we have some staff savings, too, for the rollout one. But 13-15, we look like we're in good shape for our budget. For 15-17, the green shaded column is what our estimate was this last summer when we were projecting what we would need for the 15-17 biennium. As we're refining those costs and we're working with LFO and DAS, we'll probably be a little bit under that when it comes to the final request we'll need for 15-17 by a few hundred thousand dollars. We are asking for one additional FTE for this biennium. As I was talking about data conversion a moment ago, we underestimated the amount of effort it took just to coordinate that across the programs. So we're asking for one additional FTE who will be dedicated to data conversion. And the other thing we underestimated is how much space it would take for the testing and training functions for the project. And we have a area that's in our building right by the project team that's vacant. And for another $200,000 in 15-17, we can secure that area and have the space we need to adequately perform all of the project's functions within our building. And that's the overview of our budget. For
that's
one
lovely.
Last slide, if I may.
Any questions before Mr. Smith wraps up? Okay.
So in 2017, we will be coming in and we'll talk to you about what it will cost for maintenance and support. We're estimating at this point it'll be roughly $8 million a biennium, about $4 million a year for ongoing maintenance and support costs. That will be at the level that would give us the version upgrades that I had spoken about. We'll also come in and chat about staffing alignment. As I mentioned, there might be some areas where we have efficiencies. There will be areas where jobs will change. There will be areas where we anticipate some classifications may change for the work that people do. And so we will come in and discuss with you what we think the right staffing footprint looks like for some of the areas that have changed in the organization. And then we're hopeful that in 2017 we may see some enhanced opportunities that now that we'd have visibility into our work that maybe we didn't have before, where we could offer you some opportunities as well to discuss in 2017. And that's my update.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Next.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ken Ross. I'm one of the personal income tax program managers, and I'm going to spend a few minutes talking about tax income, tax refund fraud. Let me get my slides up here. Oh, Okay, as I said, I'm just going to give a high-level brief overview of talking about tax refund fraud, and it's become quite the hot topic, not just in Oregon, but other states as well at the federal level. And I'm going to talk a little bit about, give a little background, talk about some balancing that we try to do in processing refunds, this discovery of fraud without giving away any of our trade secrets. I've got a slide that has numbers in it. Talk a little bit about a couple studies that we did to look at other fraud tools. And then at the end, I'll talk about some future strategies. And as Eric, I'm as easygoing as Eric. I'll take questions as they come up, and hopefully we can get you your answers. So a little bit about the background. Old school fraud was an altered W-2 or something on the return, enhanced deductions, decreased income, something somewhat simple and maybe simple to spot. Today's fraud is all about identity theft, and we are seeing the effects of that. Like I said, we're not immune to it. There is a big problem at the federal level. They have a little more incentive for fraud because they have giant refundable tax credits, like their earned income credits. So it's a little more incentive to go at the federal level, but a lot of times they'll link the state return with the federal return, and we'll see the same thing. I'm not an expert in identity theft. I just know it happens. We see it, the effects from it, in more than one way. We see the effects, how they get the information. That's where I'm not an expert. We know that there have been a data breach or two. Sometimes it feels lately like we're on a data breach of the month plan. And we have seen the effects of that. Last year there was a data breach in the Archdiocese of Seattle, and we saw the fallout from that. There was a tax professional in Oregon that had their system hacked, if I could use that term, last year, and we saw the effects of that also. The fraudsters are sophisticated. They've gotten smarter. I was listening to the IRS speak a month or so ago, and they were talking about a case that they're investigating where the sensitive information, the name, address, was stolen from the company system via their heating and cooling system. They had a computerized heating and cooling system, and they got in to the sensitive information that way. So, like I say, today it's all about identity theft, and all they need is a name and address and a Social Security number, and they'll make up a W-2, and they got an instant refund if we don't happen to stop it. I want to talk a little bit about the balancing act that we try to do in processing refunds. And I've gone over the slide about 100 times trying to, I listed here as conflicts, conflicting goals. May not totally be accurate, but we do have some balancing that we have to do when we process returns. I'm going to start to talk a little bit about electronically filing. So e-file returns, we've been promoting that for years, since the 90s. We were on board from day one, I believe. In fact, I think Director Jim headed that up back in the day.
Back when.
Yes. It's no secret that an e-filed return is more accurate. It's more or less costly and more efficient to process. So we absolutely have been pushing that, and we'll continue to do that. So one of the things that we have to balance is that also then allows or enables refund fraud, because really all it takes is a computer, a laptop, and an internet access, and you can create a return and ask for a refund from anywhere in the world. We also try to balance verifying the accuracy of the return with the timeliness of the refund, and there is a little bit of public pressure, I guess, if you will, on that we turn our refunds around quickly, and we attempt to do that. But we run into issues when it comes to verifying the accuracy. And for example, we don't get employer information, so the W-2 information from the employer. until it's not due until March 31st, and we're not atypical that most states have that deadline, as does the IRS. So by March 31st, we processed and sent out over half of our refunds probably. So it makes it hard to do real-time matching.
Can I clarify something about that? If I remember correctly, we did the household stuff for my mother-in-law who had a caregiver, so we were doing all of her tax, you know, the W-2s that we had to give her, and we had to have them to her by the end of January, according to law. So how come we had to have them to her by the end of January, but we, in theory, didn't have them to have you until the end of March? If they were all ready, why didn't we have to send them to you at the same time?
Madam Chair, I think that's a $64,000 question. You are correct in that the W-2 is due to the employee by the end of January, but not the information is not due to the taxing authorities till March 31st. And some of that, I believe, is to give the companies time to make corrected W-2s if they need to, so that they, when they send us the final reconciliation, it's accurate.
Madam Chair, if I may,
please.
Jim Buchholz, Director. I've asked that same question several times, and that seems to be the most common answer for why states haven't accelerated that date. There's a significant correction period, and there's more corrections than you would believe there are. And it's the employee that typically notices that there's a need for the correction, and so they don't require the sending out of the information. The W-2 and 1099 information until well after that. There are a couple of states that have accelerated that date. I think Kentucky is one of them. But most states realize that we need to have that correction period for the employee.
So in essence, we're balancing, again, we've got conflicting goals. We want to have accurate W-2 information. We want employees to have a chance to look at their W-2s and employers to have a chance to true them up. But we also want to have accurate information on file with you all so that when people take their W-2 on January 31st and file their taxes on February 5th, that you have accurate information to go by.
Madam Chair, that's correct. And in my last slide, when I talk about future strategies, we'll talk a little bit some strategies.
I didn't mean to jump the gun,
no,
but I was just really struck by that. I didn't ever realize that was the case because I was just sent mine in. Right away.
Well,
and my mother-in-law was still with us.
And we've had that conversation more than once, and we believe that it would be difficult as a state to set a deadline different than what the federal, what they have with the IRS, difficult to enforce that.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Like I said, we try to balance the refund processing with the expectation that we turn those around. Last year for refunds that didn't require a manual review, we got a refund out in 8 days. We averaged 8 days. For a manual review, the time has grown, and you'll see by the slide that we were slower, and that was an intentional slowdown so we could look at more fraud. Last year, it averaged 60 days to get a manual review done on a refund compared to 26 days the 2 years prior. And like I said, that was a lot of that was intentional. We looked at a lot more fraud returns. Some of that was just sheer volume, just trying to keep up with the number of returns that we were suspending to look at. The unfortunate piece, and this is where you get the calls from your constituents, is a lot of legitimate refunds get caught up in that process. And we realize that that's a difficult thing for not only taxpayers, but for us also to balance that. A little bit about discovery and recovery of fraud. As I said in the beginning, this has grown. I think Director Buchholz talked about this a little bit yesterday in his overview, that it's, he used a big word. He said I always say a lot. It has grown, and we'll have a slide that shows numbers that show the growth in fraud, and it is becoming increasingly difficult to detect the returns. The fraudulent returns are looking more and more like the real returns. So we do employ, we have rule-based filters. The example that Director Buchholz gave yesterday is that the federal tax subtraction, the deduction we allow on the Oregon return for tax paid to at the federal level. By statute, that's limited to a certain dollar amount, and this year it's $6,350, I believe. So if someone files a return and claims $8,000 of federal tax that they paid, we have a rule that says we're not going to allow that because statute says you only get $6,350. So that's an example of the rules that one of the rules that we employ. We have some that are specific to fraud, which, as I said earlier, I probably won't share because I don't want to share our trade secrets. We are successful. I'll show you numbers. We also know that we don't know how much fraud we miss. Mm-hmm. It's next to impossible to know what you don't know. We do find some fraud after the fact, but if a refund goes out and it was fraudulent, their chances are we may never know that. Which takes me to the recovery. It's very difficult to recover a fraudulent refund, next to impossible. Most refunds, if not all fraudulent refunds, are direct deposited. They go to a bank account or a prepaid debit card, and once it hits the account, it's gone. They either transfer it or they spend it, and our window to call the money back is very limited, and in most cases we're not successful. The other piece of that is the collection side of it. We spend little to no collection effort on fraudulent refunds that go out, mostly because we don't know who they are or where they live, because they file an Oregon return with an Oregon name and address, but that's not who actually filed for the refund, and typically they're out of state. A lot of times they're out of country. So collection efforts, we don't put any time into collection efforts.
So, Madam Kocher.
Mr. Kocher.
Thank you. I hear you. And I'm sympathetic. But it's hard to hear. How do we compare? Is this a similar issue with all the other states? Is Oregon unique?
Madam Chair,
I appreciate the candid conversation. Okay. So it's not a shoot the messenger type comment, but you have to understand. Yeah. From this perspective, it's hard to hear this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, we are not unique. We see numbers from other states, and I have numbers in here from the IRS the last year that they reported, and it is huge. We share information with other states fairly regularly, and we are not unique at all. We're not blazing a trail here with this. And I would believe that other states and the IRS would report the same thing, that they don't know. The numbers I'm going to share with you from the IRS are their estimates of what they think they missed. I'm not sure their methodology.
Let me keep listening. I guess the one thing I'm looking to hear is, I'm assuming there's an association of state Department of Revenues out there. And I'm assuming this is an issue of discussion among the Association of State Departments of Revenue.
Madam Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, absolutely. We're a member of the Federation of Tax Administrators, which is, I believe, all the states are members. And
with an income tax.
Yeah, with income tax, correct. As Eric talked about, we meet twice a year with these states. In fact, I just last month was in North Carolina, and the hot topic is fraud. We are also a member of the suspicious filer, group, and it's states. Most of them are Gentax states that where we share information, and we are sharing not just we think this name or this Social Security number is being used fraudulently. We are sharing processes and ways that we think we can get at the fraud better.
IP addresses, bank account numbers.
Yeah. So one last follow-up question. So these automatic deposits, they're going into FDIC accounts, I'm assuming. What partnership do we have with these FDIC account creators, holders, to ensure that they're verifying that the accounts being created are real accounts?
Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, we right now don't have a partnership within the banking world. I believe that's an area is in its infancy, and there I think the IRS is looking at developing a partnership, and I believe there are a couple states that are also doing that, but right now Oregon doesn't have anything like that.
And again, naively, I would assume the solution to this is making sure that those FDIC account creators, the banks, are verifying that they're real people mm-hmm. creating these accounts. Mm-hmm. You know, they're looking at the driver's license, they're looking at the Social Security numbers, mm-hmm. and making sure they're real people.
Madam Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, I think in a perfect world that would be excellent. I don't believe that there is a requirement, because you can purchase a prepaid debit card, you know, off the shelf at Walmart. So there isn't any verification needed to activate those.
And then you can reload them?
And you can reload them.
Mm-hmm. And again, please know, Madam Co-Chair, I'm not shooting the messer,
no,
messenger.
I
know you've got a level of frustration. Mm-hmm. It's just, it's hard to hear this.
Yeah. Criminals are always one step ahead of the good guys.
Madam Chair, yeah. Mr. Co-Chair, if I may just tag on to that. This was something that was kind of new to me as well, and it came to my forefront with a large software vendor that had a breach or an alleged breach where there was a significant number of refunds that were filed through this particular vendor, and it came to light in the investigation, I think in front of the IRS, as the IRS was investigating. They got to some former employees of this particular vendor, and they reported, I have no way of verifying whether this is true, I'm just telling you what they reported, that the vendor itself was suppressing the catching of this fraud because it was adding to the vendor's profit. And I suspect that the banks are in the same place. And so this was something new to me to think about just this last spring, and we'll probably be spend some time thinking about whether or not there's something that we can propose that might stop that in the future.
That is really disconcerting. Representative Nathanson, you've been very patient, and then Representative Comp.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to express appreciation to Representative Smith for beginning this line of discussion. I heard a story on the radio within the last week about, I believe it was the state attorney general in New York, it could have been another attorney general, who was being interviewed on the topic of false information in credit reports. And someone needs to take responsibility. The people who were gathering the information weren't really doing due diligence to bother to confirm that the information they were making available, basically publishing, whether it was true. Meanwhile, you can darn near ruin someone's reputation, their ability to purchase something or receive justice in court. You're placing a tremendous burden on individuals who have a hard time fighting that. And the point was, someone needs to take responsibility. And I'm hearing the same thing in this story and in the response. We have an industry that's making money off of something, yet there are many people who could suffer adverse consequences from bad information being promulgated and bad practices. I hope that it's more than just our Department of Revenue that has the discussion this spring. I hope that our State Department of Justice gets involved in thinking about ways we might be able to require parties to take responsibility. Thank you.
Well taken. And if you don't have a trusting relationship, marriages, since somebody tried to do this to us and my husband, we got a piece of mail from the IRS addressed to my husband and some other woman altogether, saying that we'd replied for a refund. And I looked at him and said, honey, is there something you have to tell me? That was entirely joking because I trusted him completely. But yes, somebody else had applied for a refund using his Social Security number with another woman's name. And fortunately, the IRS was appropriately suspicious. But It turns out the IRS has an entire process for this because it happens altogether too often. So I now have identity affidavits all over the place. It's a nuisance, but we got lucky.
Yeah.
Representative Comp.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this isn't necessarily to our presenters, but I think it's time. I guess my feeling is what Co-Chair Smith has brought up is more than a reasonable place that we ought to start investigating. Literally 20 years ago, students could hack into our school systems and change their grades. Mm-hmm. And I mean, 20 years ago, and the FBI showed up at my front door. And the good news is they recruited a couple of those students. Literally, they then did go and end up working. I mean, it's just like, their father ran into me a couple years ago. He says, "You wouldn't believe Nick is now working at the FBI." And it's like, but they have the skills.
Catch me if you can.
And so I second the idea here that we can't just say, well, it's difficult. It might be time. Yeah, just hire a couple kids. But make sure that they know what the consequences are of bad actions.
Thank you for the comments. Let me talk some numbers here. I have some numbers from the IRS that they estimated the last year that they gave out numbers, at least when we put this together, was 2013. And in that year, they estimated $29.4 billion in fraudulent refund attempts. They also estimated that they said they stopped 24.2 billion of that, so about 82% of the attempts were stopped, which means they estimated that they missed 18% of that. For Oregon, and we have a graph in there that shows the growth. Last year, we stopped over 4,700 refunds. It totaled about $7.8 million. We paid out, that we know of, we paid out 156 refunds, a net total of $144,000. I say net because we actually paid out $283,000. We recovered 138, so that 144 is net.
Let me ask a question on that really quick, and I really appreciate this. On those that did get caught, are we bringing the hammer down? And if not, we need to know this.
Madam Chair,
I feel like I'm beating up the messenger. Please know I'm not.
No. Madam Chair, Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, I don't feel beaten upon at all. We do share information with not only with our state, with the district attorneys. We also partner with the IRS because they have a bigger reach and they can get out of state. We're working on a case with them that the IRS right now that is multi-state. A lot of times it's difficult to bring criminal charges to prosecute because they don't know, like I said earlier, they don't know where they came. They can narrow down where it came from, but who might have done it, sometimes it's difficult. But we do partner with DOJ and with the IRS in that area.
Madam Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, this is a point of frustration for me. In fact, we had Department of Justice out for a meeting this last summer, because we thought we were getting close on somebody, and they couldn't get enough to be able to bring charges. I want to get somebody that we can make a big splash in the newspaper for, because I think that we'll get a big bang for our buck out of it. But just know that the methods that these fraud perpetrators use are pretty sophisticated, and they know how to hide from the authorities. And so it's frustrating to me, it's frustrating to Department of Justice, but if we can, we definitely will. They know how important this is to me.
Thank you.
Just a little bit more on the Oregon stuff. We know we paid out some. We know that because we got information after the fact, and we were able to go look at that return in our system, say, oh, that was fraud, we missed it. Some of what we got back, We got lucky, basically. Like I said earlier, the recovery is difficult. We have a very tiny window to get to go through Treasury and out to the bank to pull the money back. Most of what we got back was because the real taxpayer owed state debt and the refund offset to the state debt. And so we were able to pull it back because of that. And they're seeing that at the federal level also. We are participating in the Treasury Offset Program, so we send our state debt to the federal government. They offset federal refunds and send it in payment back to us, and more each year it seems like we're sending more of that back to the IRS because it was a fraudulent refund and shouldn't have come to us in the first place. If you take the IRS numbers and where they said they missed 18% of it, you apply that to our figures from last year, if we figure 18% that we missed 18%, it's roughly about $1.3 million that we sent out. And that's a huge, just rough guess, but just to apply, to give some context to that.
$1.3 million.
Yes, that we sent, that potentially we sent that was fraudulent.
Okay, so let me take a step back then. Obviously, every dime in the state coffers is, that's supposed to be there is good, right? And obviously, we don't want to condone or make it easy for criminals, because if they find, you know, it's a camel's nose problem, if they figure out ways to get small amounts, then they'll probably figure out ways to get larger amounts. But in actual fact, the impact at the moment on the state budget is relatively small in the grand scheme of things. I mean, $1.3 million.
Madam Chair, I would say that's true, but I would
suggest you guys are doing a pretty good job.
I would point to the graph, though.
Yeah, no, I agree.
And I would say the other thing too is that if we don't institute additional safeguards for fraud, then we'll be like that house on the corner that doesn't have the alarm system.
Right.
And that's the one that the criminals are going to go to.
No, don't get me wrong, Mr. Buchholz. I just, you know, the things that we heard first made us really nervous, as well they should, because the numbers of people who are doing this is large and growing significantly, a lot, to use your word, sir.
Yes.
Or exponentially, to use yours. But it's important that we sort of call out both numbers and say, yes, you absolutely need to do what you need to do, and we need to help you do what you need to do to prevent this from getting worse. But Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you. It's interesting numbers. So you do a good job of collecting refunds that are your fraudulent returns that you detect. And, of course, obviously, we don't know the size that you don't detect, because you don't either, and if you did detect them, you'd be going after them. So I guess my question is, do you have a wish list of detection, election detection and prevention tools and collection tools that the legislature could provide to you that would make this a better, you know, do you have such a list?
Senator Whitsitt, I'll slip you the $5 after the meeting. It's getting to that now.
I think we're about to hear yes to that question.
Senator Whitsitt, thank you for that setup. And my last slide, I will talk about some future strategies.
If you whiff that one, you're hopeless.
Just one more
and
thing.
Who
on
says general government isn't funny?
One more thing on the numbers. Just when we come back the next time and report this year's numbers, we're already at mid-June, last year's mid-June numbers, and for our number of refunds that we've stopped and the dollar amount. So January and February were huge for us, and as far as fraud goes.
So do you think then that that's because you're catching the same percentage and there are more people doing it, or do you think it's because you're better at catching them, or both?
Madam Chair, I believe it's both. I'd like to think that it's all because we're way better, but I have to be honest and say that there's more attempts.
Thank you.
A little bit about fraud studies. Somebody was in front of this committee in the last session in 13 and talked about some fraud studies that we were keying up to look at different options to help us identify fraud. We did do two of them, and so I just want to close the loop, tell you briefly what we found in doing those. We partnered with LexisNexis. Actually, they came to us and said, hey, let's run your numbers and we'll tell you what we think we see. LexisNexis is a business big data company, so they have a giant data warehouse with all kinds of public records in it, and they have analytics that they can run our tax information, so name, address, and Social Security number, and score that to tell you whether they think it's fraudulent or not, and put it in on a continuum. We sent them about 2 million records from 2011. They identified 93,000 as suspicious, so could have potential for fraud, but they couldn't actually say that it was. Of those, though, they flagged 4,800 as highly suspicious, or in our terms, as fraud, and that was about $2.2 million worth, they said. One of the things that they didn't do is they didn't share the individual results with us, so we didn't get a spreadsheet with those 4,800 fraud individuals' returns on it, so that we can compare in our system and verify if it was actually fraud or not. But it was a good indication that maybe analytics is a potential tool to help us aid in the fraud detection.
And, Madam Chair, if I might add, it's important to remember that this was a vendor that was looking to enter into a contractual relationship with the state. And so I would be surprised if the numbers were that high. But and so I just wanted to get that on the record.
Senator, I think the senator was
first. Okay, thank you. That two things about that. That's about just under $500 per flagged highly suspicious account. And the other thing is that your bar graph here shows that your detected fraud has gone up fivefold since that study. So I would question the value of the study, perhaps. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I just wanted to follow up on the nature of this study. Did we have a contract and pay to receive some data, or this was mostly something they did on spec as part of a marketing or sales pitch?
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Nathanson, it was the latter. It was absolutely part of their marketing plan. So they said, we'll run our analytics on your records at no charge in hopes that would eventually land a contract, I believe.
Follow up, please. So at some point you would need to do a cost-benefit analysis of would it be worth it to do this, but if you got to the point where you were more serious about suggesting that you have a contract with a company such as this, whether it's this one or another, for that kind of service, typically would they let you examine at least some of the results so that you could do your own spot checking and determine, are they giving you inflated numbers about the potential cost benefit? Can you verify what they're coming up with?
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Nathanson, I believe that we... and I will talk about a proposal that we have to enter into some to purchase some data analytics that we, when we come back, with that proposal, we'll have some information on verifying just that.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thanks.
All right. The second vendor that we worked with actually in 2013, so 2012, was a company out of Portland called Arm Insight, and they do data analytics also, but they focus solely on financial data. So every time a credit card or a debit card gets swiped, that gets recorded and into a database, and they had a contract with a couple of large banks where they could access that data. So every day when we created our ACH, our automated clearinghouse file that we sent to Treasury to do direct deposits, we also sent it to ARM, and they ran their analytics and sent a file back to us and flagged accounts that they thought were suspicious. We learned, as with LexisNexis, we learned a couple things, and probably the biggest thing that I learned personally is really scary what they know about you, and seeing what they came back with. In the case of ARM, we realized that with the financial data, we probably did a pretty good job. They did find fraud, but it was very limited. They found 22 returns that had gotten through, refunds that had gotten through our system that they were able to get to us in time that we could stop them or get the money back. It was about $11,000. It was really small. They found 6 that had gotten through for about $1,500. So We didn't continue that. Again, it was just another tool to help us or a project to help us see if there are benefits or other tools that we could use. We did not continue that last year. We did pay for that. It was relatively inexpensive, but it was also very labor intensive. They sent us a file back every day, and we manually had to review each entry on that file. And we had decided that because they weren't finding a whole lot and the resources that it would take to automate that process for us were tied up in Eric's project in our core system replacement, we decided not to mess with that. So, but again, like I said, it was a project to allow us to look at different things, and the analytics being one of the big major players out there, which leads me to my last slide. Our future strategies. We know that fraud is evolving. They've gotten way more sophisticated. We know that we, in order to keep up or attempt to keep up, we have to get also as sophisticated. We will continue to use our internal business rules. We're pretty successful at that. We'll tweak them. We look at them annually in our current system. It's not very nimble. We make annual changes. Depending on what it is, we may be able to make a tweak or two during this season. When we roll out in Gentax at the end of this year, we'll be able to do that daily if we need to. It's much more nimble and easier to make changes. We've dedicated staff resources. We have moved people around. We've taken them off other work to help us with fraud. We will continue to do that. Because it's evolving so much, it's probably not unreasonable to think that it's a possibility we'd be back here after we get a couple years of Gentax under our belt to see what it can do for us, that we potentially could be asking for funding for a dedicated fraud team. As soon as we roll out in Gentax, we will immediately become one of the states that can exchange information nightly, and Eric talked about that. That data exchange will jump right into that as soon as we roll out. And we, as Eric said, we're the number 20 on the list, so we'll be sharing information daily with the 19 other states, and it's information that we can use to ping our tax refunds off of, and as well as other states can do that.
Can I interrupt once again? Yeah. With regard to the things that you're proposing, I'm just thinking about the identity quizzes because this came up at an earlier hearing and we talked about it a little bit. I think they're great and they make a lot of sense. Do most of the... I'm trying to figure out how to articulate this question. Does Gentax have built into it the ability to generate those?
Madam Chair, ability to generate...
Generate identity quizzes for the system. So like, if somebody wants a refund, then they can... Does Gentax have the ability to interact with public databases so that it will ask me whether I've ever been either passed the bar, been licensed as a physician, or had a teacher certification, and I better darn well say I've been licensed as a physician or we're in trouble, right?
Right.
So does it have that ability to built in?
Madam Co-Chair, it's not built in, but it does have that ability, and that's one of the reasons we'll be back asking for a little bit of money to do that fast. We'll build that for us and integrate it with the with Gentax and the data analytics that we're also proposing. So let me jump into the proposed, and maybe that will answer your question.
Thank you.
So we are proposing, somebody will be back in front of this committee, I assume it's in phase two, with our policy option packages. And we have it might be split into two packages, but dedicated towards fraud. And the first one is to purchase commercial data analytics. And it won't be with LexisNexis. Fast Enterprises has partnered with Thomson Reuters, another big data company, and they have integrated that analytics into Gentax so that with each night when we run the returns, it will automatically go out. It'll bring the information back. It will put the information. It becomes ours. It goes into our data warehouse. We're proposing to use public data to help detect fraud, and the way it works high level is it will score a return from one end to this is a legitimate return, to the other end this is a fraud return, and then anything in the middle, we will determine. We'll set a range where we're not comfortable, we need more information, and we'll send a letter. We'll build an identity quiz. We'll send a letter, say, please get online or give us a call and answer these five or six questions that will validate your identity. So we will build that piece of it, assuming we get approval for the funding, but that would be part of the analytics. And the last piece that we're proposing is that we send some money, we get some money, a little bit, not a lot, that we send to our friends at Employment Department so they can change their employer form and reprogram their system to capture additional W-2 information, and they can send that to us quarterly so that we can begin to build our database before the season starts each year, and we will have employer W-2 information in there so that we can do some real-time matching.
So just to follow up on that, because this was part of our W-2 conversation earlier in today's meeting, in essence what you're saying is that the errors are usually on the order of 5 to 10% maybe of someone's W-2 as opposed to an order of magnitude. So if you get real-time data or essentially quarterly data from employment related to figures that are submitted to employment from employers, then you'll be able to see if something comes in and there's just a significant discrepancy, if it's double the amount or half the amount or something.
Madam Chair, that's correct. Without divulging percentages or anything like that.
I'm not asking. I mean, I'm just asking if I'm in the general ballpark of it's generally in this percent, and if you see something that's that percent, then you'll have the ability to flag that more easily before you get the W-2s from the employer.
Madam Chair, they may be larger. But at least with this particular option, we're not inconveniencing the taxpayer at all. The taxpayer still has that correction period for whatever they deem is in need of correction. We'll be able to use the data, and if we're close, then we'll probably say that's legit. If it's not close, and we can set that level at wherever we where we think it's most reasonable, then we'll be able to stop those refunds. And we'll be able to even interpolate if we only have 3/4 of data because somebody has filed particularly early, we'll be able to interpolate.
Got it. Thank you. Senator Whitson?
Thank you. Oh, just one last question. For the Department of Revenue, is your return on investment better for time and money spent in auditing or time and money spent in looking for fraud?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitson, Madam Chair, Senator Whitson, I did
okay,
it too.
Okay, we're kind of interchangeable sometimes.
I think it's both and either. I mean, it depends on the particular situation. We had a particularly large fraudulent refund that went out a couple of years ago, and that caused us to make some changes to the way that we did business, including taking an auditor out of regular production and embedding them into the suspense unit to be able to look at it, because we thought at the time that particular function was more necessary to stop another one of those happening. It depends on the type of auditor. Some of our auditors are particularly productive for the types of audits that they do, and other auditors do things that maybe the ROI isn't quite as high, but we do something to establish a presence in other areas that where they can tell their other friends that they were audited on a particular issue. So it's something that shifts depending on where we think that the resource is best put.
And Madam Chair, if I could add on that to a little bit, when it comes to fraud and refunds that go out, and it's a hard comparison because there's little to no chance of recovery, whereas in an audit, we could, if something wasn't right and we audit them, we could get the money back. And in fraud, the money's gone. And so there really is no comparison. Either you catch it up front.
So we, in essence, collect 100% of those adjustments.
Yes.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, that's all I had. Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Ross or Mr. Fields? Co-Chair Smith.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I want to go back to the identity theft. I just can't let that go. Sorry. Representative Nathanson said something really powerful the other day when, and I don't remember who was in front of us, but she pointed out that we make the laws. Mm-hmm. That's our job.
Yeah.
And so the more I think about identity theft and these FDIC accounts, both on the prepaid cards and on bank accounts, would it make sense for us to have a greater conversation on identifying who are the people that are purchasing these? Let me tell you where I'm going with this. A decade ago, Oregon had a meth epidemic. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And we decided we were going to identify and record who's purchasing the key ingredient that went into this. And everyone thought the world was going to come to an end.
Right.
But in a bipartisan manner, we all voted for this, and somehow the sun came up the next day.
Yeah.
I don't know how, but it did. To me, it just seems like on this issue of identity theft with prepaid cards, there ought to be a solution of identifying and at least recording who's purchasing these. Now, I know it's a broader discussion than Department of Revenue. I get all that. But I just wonder if you had a mechanism to be able to identify who's purchasing these cards, it perhaps might give another tool to go back and identify the fraudulent individuals, at least the dumb ones.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, I think that that ought to be a topic of conversation between us. Yeah, I would say that it may be more effective to go against or go up against the banks themselves rather than trying to get to these slippery fraud perpetrators who seem to do a pretty good job of hiding their identity.
So really quick,
but if we can get somebody on the bank side that provide these bank accounts for people to populate with the fraudulent refunds, then that might be something to really explore.
So, and I know time's coming to an end here, but why wouldn't we get some of your key folks together, get some of our key folks together, mm-hmm. and get the Oregon Bankers Association together and sit down and have a conversation?
I think that's a good discussion to have.
Say, what are we going to do on this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I agree.
Back to what Rep. Nathanson said, we create the laws.
Right.
If there's a problem, let's figure out the solution. Can we talk about that?
Yeah.
We're going to visit more about this.
Okay. Let's do it.
Okay. Thank you.
Let's do it.
I think that's it. Anything else? We good?
Perfect.
You guys got through this on time with lots of questions.
Yeah.
All right. Anything else, Mr. Co-Chair? Mr. Gordon? Thank you very much.
Thank you for the conversation.
All right, we're adjourned. Thanks. All right, we're adjourned. Thanks.